Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me? Now, this is a really interesting session, I think, today, and we're going to leave space for all of you to ask questions, because we're really going to talk about our future. And that is a subject which couldn't be more interesting at this moment, particularly with the panel we have today. So I'm going to introduce you to two people. They're rather young, by my account, really, here. And then there's Rosie and I in the middle, Rosie Boycott. But these are two people who are both social historians, anthropologists, economists, who have captured the imagination of the public in a really interesting way. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people even, are listening to what they say, trying to find a way to understand the world, to look back at the past, to see the future, which is very difficult to see which way it's going to go. And this is a future which all of you, all of us, are going to participate in. So let me just first of all introduce Ha-Joon Chang, who's over there, and who's a professor at Cambridge University. Is it professor?
Reader.
Whatever they call him, reader, yes. Ha-Joon has written a lot of books. A lot of them have had a lot of attention. He was brought up in Korea, and Korea itself is a fascinating example of both an economy and the kind of social history in the past. In the past decade, the decade before that, which has broken some taboos, and for better or for worse, we can hear about later. He's also written very eloquently about China, which, as you all know, is very much in the news at the moment. One of the things, the book that has really captured the imagination, and both these guys have written two books which really are much talked about everywhere, so you're very lucky to have them here. 23 things they didn't tell you about capitalism, yeah. Is what Ha-Joon, and amongst those there are all kinds of fascinating chapter headings to all of this, and he's also written an economic guide, a user's guide to economics. So in lots of ways this is a learning curve here. So we'll come back to Ha-Joon Chang in a minute. Now, Yuval Noah Harari, who was sitting next to me next to the pool yesterday, which is where I first met him, has also written a book which has absolutely captured the imagination. It's a very simple project. It's called Sapiens, a brief History of Humankind. Of course, what it does is, this is good because it looks at human nature, who we were, going back to Neanderthal times, looking forward to the future. The span of history that you engage with is very, very wide. And the implications and the lessons from the agricultural age, from the age of the Industrial Revolution, from the future, and who we are and how we behave in this new technological age are absolutely fascinating. And I think you know Rosie Boycott, who's here, a distinguished journalist, and who is fascinated by these topics and knows a lot of this work. And Rosie is here with me to help open up this topic and interrogate these two philosophers here. So the first thing I want to ask is, looking to the future and looking back at the past and the lessons, we're at a precarious moment now because we've just been in a world recession. We hear all this stuff about the third world and China, and we know that the technology revolution is running away with itself. So I want to ask each of you, in terms of both the social and economic future, what can happen which could transform things? What are the possibilities and what are the dangers? So first of all, Ha-Joon Chang, from your experience, what would you say?
Yes, well, you know, Yuval has written this really amazing book looking at 70,000 years of human history. I cannot even begin to compare what I do to what he does. I mean, I basically concentrate in the last 300 years, usually last 70 years since the Second World War, but from my kind of rather limited perspective, you know, I mean, the rise of capitalism has really, I mean, fundamentally that transformed human society. And, you know, this I talk about from my own perspective, experience. Yeah? When I was born in 1963 in South Korea, the country was one of the poorest countries in the world. We had a per capita income that was only 40% that of Ghana in Africa. I mean, our per capita income was 20% that of countries like Chile and Argentina. Infant mortality, i.e. number of the babies that die within the first year, was at a level that is comparable to what they have in Haiti today. So it was a really poor country, and I mean, from the 60s, we had the so-called economic miracle. It wasn't, as many people mistakenly believe, the result of pure capitalism. It was a very kind of complicated mixture of the government and the market, yeah? Capitalism and socialism. But this industrial transformation that has happened completely changed the lives of people there. You know, it's not just about having another iPhone. It's not just about having another TV in the bedroom. No, I mean that when you are a developing country, I mean, which I roughly define as countries that are with less than, say, $10,000 per capita income, you know, economic growth and industrialization is literally a life of matter of life and death. Yeah? Yeah. Because if you develop your economy well, people live longer, they have to do less back-breaking work, they don't have to see their children die like flies, and they lead a much healthier life. So, you know, this is a transformation that is very, very kind of powerful. But the trouble is that this machine called capitalism or modern industrial economy or whatever we may like to call it needs to be carefully controlled. You know? Exactly because this is so powerful. If you don't handle it well, it can destroy lots of things.
Controlled by whom?
Well, collectively. Yeah? And that's where I actually meet Yuval at the kind of philosophical level. You know, what is so unique about human nature, and this is when I read him writing about this, I mean,
about biology,
jumped with joy,
makeup,
you know,
yes.
That the unique thing about humans is that they have imagination. They can imagine another world. They can imagine a collectivity that doesn't really exist, yeah? I mean, the famous phrase from British American political scientist Benedict Anderson, imagine communities. Yeah? So we, you know, I think, oh yeah, I'm a Korean, but what is Korea? I mean, 50 million people who may not be necessarily genetically related to each other, and Korea is one of the most genetically homogeneous nations in the world. Yeah? But Korea's like that in Colombia, you know, I mean, the country called Colombia exists only in human imagination, fractally.
Well, let me ask before we come.
Let me just finish it. Yeah, but exactly because we can imagine another world, we can use this machine called capitalism in many different ways, and I think that is why we need some collective dialogue and discussion, yeah, nationally, internationally, because if we handle this stupid way, we will destroy the planet, we will destroy humanity's future. But if we do it well, you know, you can transform many people's lives in the most amazing way.
What's really interesting, because I was lucky enough to interview Yuval the day before yesterday, on what you say about what Korea was able to do, that obviously there was a really strong leadership by the Korean government. Now, something that you said to me just 48 hours ago that struck me as so interesting was that as we went into the future, governments would be able to lead less. Can you expand on that? Because it seemed to me one of the really big things you talked about. Where would leadership be? And in a way, to take his story forward, Korea did something astonishing. Is this the last time we're going to see something like that?
Hmm. Yes, in the 20th century, politics was characterized by enormous visions. politicians and political movements had enormous visions about the future of humankind. Many of these visions were terrible. We're talking about the Nazi vision, we're talking about the Stalinist vision, the Maoist visions. You can say a lot of bad things about Stalin and Hitler and Mao, but you can't accuse them of being narrow-minded. They had really grand visions of the future.
Yeah. Very good.
And also the liberals had grand visions of the future. Not all the visions were bad either. But this was the main characteristic of politics in the 20th century, huge visions. And then you come to the early 21st century, and the main characteristic of politics is that nobody has any vision. The governments of the world has been transformed from leaders to managers. A leader is somebody who sees to the future, say 20 years, 30 years, and tries to shape this future, to bring the country from here to there. A manager, which is most governments today, they manage the day-to-day business of the country, the education, the sewage system, the literary festivals. This runs relatively well in most places. But they don't have any idea what the world would be like in 20 or 30 years, or where we would like it to be. And this is the main thing that is missing. They have a justification. A justification is called neoliberalism, which is, many governments love neoliberalism because neoliberalism tells them, you don't need to have a vision, it's bad to have a vision.
That's right.
You don't need to think about the future, it's bad to think about the future. Because then you start interrupting market forces. You just need to manage whatever little bit you are focused on and leave everything else to market forces, and it will be wonderful. It will be the best world possible.
But
and
you,
this is the danger.
But you, Yuval, just spoken. I think this issue of where leadership belongs, and I know this was discussed yesterday, is a very crucial issue. But you've just talked about three people, Mao, Hitler, and Stalin, all of whom paradoxically for a while were loved by their nation and their people. You know, even when they murdered their
relatives. You had to love them.
You had to love them, yeah. That's absolutely true. But really this notion of this sort of ambition for a communal vision, for a vision which is shared and is that really, how realistic and feasible is it? We have a global economy now, we have the internet, we have a virtual world out there which is frightening in itself. So how will this happen? Do you either have ideas about where we're going?
The fact that you said it's in market forces, does it actually mean that it's in Silicon Valley and in the hands of the Steve Jobses mm-hmm. of this world? Because they are doing something that is now so far ahead of all of us, intellectually and understanding-wise. I mean, all of us can get our heads around the Industrial Revolution, but this is a different revolution, which has left the majority of mankind standing. Mm. And is this going to be empowering, disempowering? Does it mean that leadership moves, you know, this horrible term, leave it to the market? What's the consequence of leaving it to the market into the next 10, 20 years?
Yeah, actually, I think we need to question this very idea of leaving things to the market. Okay, I think we need to question this very notion of leaving things to the market. Well, that's what the kind of standard economic theory, the neoliberal the ideas tell you. But, you know, market is only the veil. You know, behind them are these big corporations, people with their own vision of how human society needs to be organized. And unless you understand that, you know, I mean, these people find it very easy to hide behind the veil of market, but actually these people are reshaping the world in their own image. So for example, when the European Union and the United States are talking about this thing called Transatlantic Economic Partnership or something like that.
TTIP.
This is presented as a trade agreement. But actually, that's not true because already there's a very little trade barrier between Europe and North America. So this is really about increasing corporate power, where
corporate power without any measure of the government being able to change it.
Corporations can literally take governments to this private tribunal run by three lawyers.
Yes, terrifying.
Yeah, where well, we can, they can say that you cannot regulate these companies because it reduces their profit. Yeah?
Well, we can see something at the moment, which is a small story perhaps, but we know that in the United Kingdom, and I don't know what happens in South America, but Starbucks, Amazon, Apple, they don't pay any tax.
Exactly.
And governments submit to this because they need this to fuel the economy in some way, and that is, they are governments increasingly in the hands of corporates.
Yes, all these tax things, you know, the government say that we need to give them the lenient treatment with taxes because they come and create jobs and so on, but we have to also think about the public investment they take advantage of, you know, that they are taking it for free. So, I mean, if you want to create, 30,000 jobs with the money that you lose because of tax evasion, I'm sure you can create many more jobs. But somehow this corporate vision of the world where corporations have no nationality, they choose to set up themselves in tax havens as a paper company so that they don't have to pay any taxes, take advantage of the poor labor laws in China and other countries. You know, that we have somehow bought into this vision, and that's what's truly frightening, because people think we have to accept this because this is done by this invisible hand of the market. No, there are very visible hands of corporations behind this.
Yuval, something you said the other day was that it is possible that new types of leadership could emerge from somewhere like Silicon Valley. Can you expand on that? Because we didn't have a chance the other day. That might be better or worse. I mean, as Alan said, they could be Mao, they could be Hitler, they could be whatever.
Well,
they could be Donald Trump. They are Donald Trump.
God help us.
Well, I'll say something in favor of the corporations, that at least they are trying. At least,
what,
like
trying
people
to do something other than make money,
are trying to have a vision for the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, I think what we have to realize is that what's at stake is not just the usual stuff of the 19th and 20th century of social issues and unemployment and taxes and things like that. It's rerunning the big debates of the last two centuries. But the really big debates of the 21st century are going to be completely different, because technology and science are changing the fundamental nature, not only of the economy, but of reality and of human beings.
Yes.
Throughout history, you had many revolutions, but one thing remained constant, which is human beings themselves. We still have the same bodies and brains we had 20,000 years ago. The next revolution will change that. Mm. The main products of the 21st century will not be vehicles or coffee or textiles. They'll be bodies and minds. And the really big questions concern what are we going to do with this new ability to engineer and to manufacture bodies and brains and minds. And my main concern is that governments are not thinking about it. If corporations are thinking about it, it's better than nothing. I mean, I prefer that Steve Jobs or Mark Zuckerberg will think about it than that nobody thinks about it and it's just left really to the invisible hand of the market. So we could improve on the corporations or on Silicon Valley, but at least they are taking some steps to try and envision what artificial intelligence might do to the world. And you see today that people like Bill Gates are starting to sound the alarm, artificial intelligence is coming, we should think about it. And if nobody else is sounding the alarm, and Obama is not sounding the alarm, that at least Bill Gates is. So in this sense, we can say something positive about this.
Can I ask you something, to talk about some issues about the future? The Industrial Revolution changed a lot. And there is also the issue of what we do with our lives, how we employed. Is artificial intelligence going to take over in such a way? We already take for granted that we live in a more and more virtual world, as you've just said. How much do we know about our children that Amazon doesn't know? What they read, what they eat, what they do, how they spend their lives. how many things, how much human contact is there between us? The book that your father gave you 20 years ago, no, he won't anymore. How many books do you have? Why are they there in your home? I mean, I mention all these things because they also, they empower certain people, and all this power is in the hands of very, very few people. Mm-hmm. So do we trust these people? Is human nature, you've studied a bit of human nature, is it to be trusted that these powerful figures can begin to control the world and know more about us and our lives and control it than in the future? How do we control that? We're not controlling it now.
Yeah, I mean, this is why we need to debate the kind of issues that he just mentioned, because view that all these things will be somehow resolved through market forces, but the markets themselves are politically constructed. You know, 200 years ago, a lot of Americans thought it was perfectly fine to buy and sell people as slaves. Yeah? You know, 100 years ago, a lot of people were in favor of child labor, you know. I mean, 30 years ago, if you argued for environmental protection, they thought you were some kind of crypto communist, yeah? Wanting to bring down capitalism from within, you know. But we have restructured all these markets to, well, make it better. So I think we need to debate these things and decide that, well, this is the kind of market we want to have in, I don't know, genetic engineering services, and this is the kind of market we want to have in terms of information exchange and so on, and we have to confront this.
Were they talking about this in Davos, or we're talking about it at Hay in Catalonia, but who is going to debate, we can debate these issues, but who are those both empowered and enabled to make change as a consequence of regulation, because it's got mm-hmm. to be global. It can't simply be, you know, unilateral, one country saying one and the other. How does this happen?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm a naive Democrat. Naive Democrat. But, you know, in the end, it's the people who have to do this. You know, I mean, the people who have the power and money from the status quo will never want to change it. Yeah? It's only because that a lot of people fought for these things that slavery has been abolished, that child labor has been abolished, that we are at least trying to regulate the environment better. So yes, everyone should be aware of this. Everyone should have a debate. This is why, you know, that we come here and try to, you know, well, that agitate people.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
Yuval, you say that you know, if we're not very careful, we're going to move. We think we have inequality in the world now. We could have even wider inequality as we head into the future. Can you explain how that would be, and do you, either of you, think there is a way to avoid that, given what we know is coming technologically?
Yes, I mean, I don't believe in technological determinism. With exactly the same technology, you can build completely different societies. I mean, with the technology of the Industrial Revolution, same technology, you can build the Soviet Union of Stalin, you can build Nazi Germany, and you can build a liberal democracy. With exactly the same machines and electricity and steam engines and so forth. And this is also true of the future. There are technological determinists who say artificial intelligence is coming, it's going to be like that, and there is nothing we can do to stop it, and it's never true. Technology always gives several options. It's true that you can't stop it completely. We don't want to have computers at all, won't happen. But what to do, you have options. One of the options, which is very frightening, is the opening of extreme gaps, much bigger than we saw in the 19th and 20th century, much, much bigger than today. It can come in two flavors or two ways. The less radical way is that new technology, especially artificial intelligence, makes most people completely useless, redundant from an economic perspective. So most people lose their jobs, most people lose entirely their economic value, and the vast majority of wealth and power remains concentrated in the hands of either a very small human elite, which controls the new technology, or even in the hands of a non-human elite. Yeah. We are very close to the point where we give algorithms legal rights. we recognize algorithms as legal persons the same way that we recognize corporations as legal persons. Mm. We can recognize algorithms as legal persons, and within 50 years, the world may be controlled by non-human algorithms that hold most of the wealth. So this is the less radical option. The more radical option is if you add biotechnology into the mix, you can get, even within the lifetime of people here, you can get a superhuman elite. And if most of history, the gaps between rich and poor, and rich countries and poor countries, were only economic and social and political, in the not too distant future, they might be biological. You'll see maybe humankind splitting into different species with superhumans, an elite of superhumans, right, yeah, with super abilities. Now, this is not science fiction. It's something that is within reach in a few decades. On the other hand, it's not deterministic. The technology may enable this, but it doesn't force us to go in that direction. So these are several of these scenarios that we have to keep in mind when we are thinking about the future. Again, not the future in 1,000 years, the future of, say, 50 years or 80 years from now.
But let's just ask you, if we know that technology has got the capacity to do things that will create profit for some, not for others, which will put people out of work, which does not read the human capacity other than, you know, because we can also create through AI other people who can do it much better than us. And all of us experience this every day as we go on to Google or elsewhere and realize that we don't have to spend that time doing that. But how, when you say there is an option, you know, the Industrial Revolution provided options, you'd go this way or that way, this is tougher. I mean, given that it makes such sense, and because in the early stages of the internet, people could see all the opportunities, it was liberating, it was democratizing. Well, now it looks like it's gone into the exact opposite direction. So how do you realistically, pragmatically, you know, the United Nations was created after the Second World War to deal with problems about, you know, of the kind. This is a bigger problem altogether. How do we bring people together who can make decisions which will take us in the right direction?
I think one of the difficult things we must realize is that probably all the political institutions and thinking that we have inherited from the last 300 years are outdated and irrelevant, and you won't be able to solve this kind of problem with 20th century politics, including with 20th century democratic politics. One of the very big problems is that in order to engage in this debate, you need the kind of scientific knowledge that the vast majority of people simply don't have. And I'm not talking about holding a PhD in biology or computer science. You don't need that, but you need something. And again, I think one of the problems is that politics as we know it has been shaped in an era where science was important, but it wasn't the most important thing. You can engage in most of the important political debates and have relatively well-founded ideas without really understanding much about the most advanced scientific developments. But this is no longer the case. If you want to engage in the really important debates of the 21st century, you simply need the kind of knowledge that the vast majority of the population doesn't have. Now, you can approach this in all kinds of ways. You can say, okay, so only the elite should be in the debate. Or you can say, no, we should give this knowledge, we should invest in giving the necessary knowledge to the vast majority of people. You can do many things with this realization. The one thing you cannot do is just say, oh, we have the democratic institutions from the 20th century, they can deal with it. They can't. Democracy as we know it today, as has been inherited from the 20th century, is incapable of confronting these kinds of issues.
So from both of you, I mean, how do we educate our children to best prepare for this and to become the right kind of leaders who, I mean, you say we need to have this a level of understanding. That's an enormous leap for most people's brains to even get off the first rung. What do you do?
Yeah, no, I think I mean, once again, I go back to this the point of human imagination, because that, you know, we have to realize how powerful human beliefs can be compared to the power of technologies. Yeah? So in a lot of countries, abortion is illegal. Yeah? A lot of people that don't want abortion, it's not because we don't have the technology to have abortion. I mean, it's a very simple technology, but you know, many societies have resisted this for centuries. I'm not necessarily endorsing one or the other view here, but you know, this shows how powerful what people believe in, how powerful what they think is the right thing is. And this means that, as Yuval pointed out, we really need to inform people very, very well. And unfortunately, because of the rise of this don't get me wrong, I'm not anti-capitalist, I'm not entirely anti-cooperation, but you know, because of the rise of the corporate power and rise of this market ideology, we now have reduced education to basically training ground for corporations. Yeah.
Well, let's come to this issue of education.
Mm-hmm.
There is the internet. There is a possibility of communicating ideas. There is a lot of noise on the internet. There's a lot of abuse on the internet.
That's right,
now. Yeah. There's a lot of misinformation. There's a lot of lies on the internet. You know, how can you, and in what still is supposedly an area of liberal democracy in the West, which controls most of this technology and the rest of it, how do you create the possibility of not just bringing people into a room, but having a conversation in which there really can be a dialogue and these issues can be raised and shared?
Yeah.
Is that must be one route, but is it possible?
No, this is why you need a better education, not just better in terms of employability, which is all that counts today.
But be employed?
Giving people the critical ability to think. Yeah? I mean, these days a lot of countries say, well, we are going to shut down the Department of German Literature and Social Anthropology because they don't make money. We cannot make these people hired by the corporations. But, you know, that kind of thinking should be challenged, and we basically have to educate people so that they learn the ability to think critically, because, you know, frankly, I cannot imagine what knowledge these people should have, our children should have in 30 years' time. You know, the world will have
Yuval is doing
changed,
a course.
Tremendously. Yeah?
Your course about humankind, you've got about 100,000 people at least, haven't you, listening into you. So you are using the internet to spread to make people think about not what's in front of them, you know, today, but what the possibilities are, and to think about it and to share that. You're trying to have that conversation, aren't you? Isn't that what you're trying to do with your course?
Yes, I think that more generally speaking, what both of us are trying to do, and what I think more and more scientists should do, is break the wall between science and politics,
that's right,
between the university and the market, the university, and parliament. I mean, again, for looking back 200 years, there was a kind of deal between the scientists and the politicians that none intervenes in the realm of the other. And it's very comfortable for the politicians, because they don't have the scientists poking their nose into these issues with all their crazy ideas and complicated theories. And it's also very comfortable for the scientists who say, oh, I just do pure science. All this politics, it's not my concern. And then you have the connection that money comes from the political system to the academy. And in return, every now and then, the politicians come and say, okay, we need a nuclear bomb. Can you produce a nuclear bomb for us? Wonderful. So do that. But what will be the uses of the nuclear bomb? Leave it to us. We'll take care of everything else. You just solve the technical issues. And I think this worked in the 20th century. It can no longer work in the 21st century. And I think that not only politicians, but also most scientists don't want to hear these news. They don't want to get involved in politics, in society. They just want to be left alone in their laboratories and do their interesting things. But I think that it can't work. I mean, it can work, but then the consequences are very dangerous. Because when you live in a world where the most powerful force of change comes from these laboratories, you can no longer just go on with the traditional method of I'm just focusing on the technical issues and the political and social implications are not my concern.
Well, what about this coming now to again to the momentum? We talked about market forces, we've talked about technology, we've talked about biology. What about this word, a very simple word, which is undervalued and is important, ethics, fairness, inequality? I mean, that's very much at the heart of this. What is right for the world? Now, are there enough trustworthy people who are leaders? You know, Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, you know, who you name them. Are these people who are not self-interested, who are prepared to engage with these issues? I mean, and if not, how can we bring that about? How can equity, equitable decisions, which are good for the welfare of everyone, be done, but still allowing people the freedom to express themselves and to, you know, to follow their passions? How is that going to happen?
Well, I think here economists are really to blame because, you know, basically in preaching the virtues of the market, we have created a world where, you know, basically the logic of the wealth and power of money have replaced any ethical beliefs. So basically, you know, I often half jokingly say that economics has become the equivalent of Catholic theology in medieval Europe. Yeah? It has become a system that justifies whatever is going on because the kind of philosophy behind, well, at least the dominant school of the economics today is that, you know, whatever market produces, we have to accept. Yeah? No one knows better than the market, and this is what you have to accept. And, you know, we don't need any ethics. Yeah? I mean, people basically seek pleasure and try to avoid pain. And if this produces, you know, too much, the sugary drinks or the alcohol on supermarket shelves, well, who are you to say that this is wrong? You know, this is what people want. Yeah? But actually, this has its implicit ethical position, which is that whatever individuals with money wants should be given. Yeah? Because when you think about it, market is not one person, one vote. It's $1, one vote. Yeah?
Yeah.
So that this is an ethical system which basically says those who have money can shape the society in their image, and we have to confront this. I mean, I'm not necessarily saying that this is the worst ethics that you can have, but you know, that it is an ethical system, and we have to have a debate about that.
But so it certainly, when you read Yuval's book and when you just look around you, the world gets smaller and smaller. It's fantastic that everybody here, there's probably, you know, half of this audience is wearing a shirt that came from the same town in China.
Right.
We live in one world now. Mm-hmm. Therefore, this world means that our governments have less power, corporations have less power, the chances of gross inequality seem to me to get more. And yet you talk always about, well, we still don't seem to be further on from let the market decide. What would be your vision, I mean, of how in a one world we would make it a better world?
Well, you know, one thing I want to start with is you know, this globalization has actually made things more difficult to control, but this was this also has given excuses to people who actually don't want things to be controlled not to do anything about it. Because, for example, take the case of this worker suicide in this factory called Foxconn in China. You know, the working conditions are so harsh. Dozens of workers committed suicide in a span of like 3 years. It became a scandal. And then, yeah, people said that, isn't this company supplying Apple? And Apple said, it has nothing to do with us because that factory in China is owned by a company which is based in Taiwan who sells things to us. Yeah? So they could just wash their hands off it, but I mean, just think about it.
They couldn't wash their hands off it if if the law of a land said,
yeah,
no, you can't do that.
But you don't have a land anymore,
exactly,
that's
yeah,
the point. We have no land. It's like going back to the Tito trade.
But Apple actually could change things. I mean, if it said we don't want the factories to be run like that, they will have changed it. And actually, Foxconn factory, after this scandal, increased worker wages by 30%. They had the money to do it. Yeah, but Apple could just wash its hands of it. The American government could say, well, yeah, it's something that happened in China, not us. So that we really need to have a new system to kind of allocate responsibilities.
So
and
what's that new system?
Sorry?
What would be the new system?
Oh, no, that's, No. First of all, you know, you can actually do a lot by tightening national level regulations. Mm-hmm. You know, especially when it comes to rich, powerful nations in Europe, North America, Japan,
okay, but
they could actually do a lot of things that simply by tightening the local regulations. But we need the kind of aggressive approach to this the uncontrolled power of money. So, for example, you know, the last time I was having this conversation with Mr. Piketty, and you know, this issue of tax havens arose. Yeah? And I pointed out, look, I mean, that tax havens are not like the Andes Mountains. Yeah, these exist only because the powerful government wanted them to exist.
To
yeah, I mean, just imagine. I mean, if the 20 most powerful governments decided that from tomorrow, any financial transaction involving even in a secondhand way that entities registered in these designated tax havens will be considered illegal, you know, they'll disappear, yeah? I mean, they are not like the Andes Mountains, like not like the Pacific Ocean. So that these things actually can be done. I mean, it's not that difficult. I mean, of course, it's the absence of political will, yeah?
Let me ask another thing about looking at America, for instance. There's an election going on now. We all laughed about Donald Trump, but it's happening. But something that's always fascinated me about the United States, and it's slightly different in the United Kingdom and in other parts of the world, is that the people who are the most disadvantaged in America all want to vote Republican. Mm. And the Republican Party, in whatever phase it's in, but now in the most terrible phase, is the least likely to do them any good whatsoever. And it's plainly spoken. It's quite clear. And yet, they want that. So can we rely on the public? And what about this idea of public opinion? Because what I think you're saying is, we need to educate people. People need to come out and know and understand and not stand for it. Not just how they vote in elections, but also what they say, how they come out. Now, how do you educate the public in that way when quite a lot of the public, for instance, even in one of the most sophisticated democracies mm-hmm. in the world, apparently vote for, you know, God knows what, absolutely the wrong party, you know, in every way.
Well, the reason that I think that they vote for the Republican, it's the same in Israel, where the disadvantaged people are voting for Netanyahu again and again, is they understand something beyond these market issues. They provide people with meaning. They provide people with a story. They provide people with some identity, national or religious. And this is really priceless. This is really way beyond if I have a few more dollars every month or not. Again, this is one of the things that's happening behind the screen of the market, is this all the issue of meaning and of identity. Mm. And you see it in many places around the world, and especially I think left-wing liberal intellectuals find it too easy to scoff at the masses that they prefer meaning and identity over a few more dollars in their pockets. And in historical terms, for me as a historian, it's obvious why people would vote for somebody who provides them with a very strong tribal story, even if his or her economic policies are not the best, are not in their best interests, according to some economic theory.
Well, let's come to a really fascinating other topical issue, which is about, we could look at Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood. Under Mubarak in Egypt, there was a real sense that a revolution, and the revolution was actually, you know, a genuine urge. Mm. And yet, there was no organization, And if you looked at the way that ordinary Muslims, believing Muslims in Egypt, had been treated by that regime, it was appalling. Mm. But they were convinced that the next life was the one that mattered, and that those people who encouraged that. Now, here is an example. You know, a young Muslim boy, jihadist wife, was asked, well, aren't you desolated by the death of your husband? And she said, what do you mean desolated? He's gone to the right place. That's what it's about. So these feelings are so irrational and so problematic, and yet they're shared, obviously, by more and more people who are disadvantaged and disillusioned and are seeking meaning. But this meaning is a false illusion, at least. I think you would agree with me, but...
No, but I mean,
explain,
those meanings can be provided in many different ways, yeah? And, you have to develop alternative stories that give meaning to people's lives, yeah? I mean, whatever that is, I mean, people have died for lots of things. I mean, their tribal identity, the communist ideology, you know, the nationalism against their neighbors, you know.
Hitler's revival of German nationalism.
Exactly, yeah. So that there isn't just one way of providing meaning. And I think Yuval is absolutely right. I mean, without providing meaning, you cannot pull people together to engage in a collective project. But the question, therefore, is what meaning do you provide to people?
And who owns the right to tell that story?
Yeah, well,
that's the big
exactly,
issue, isn't
yeah.
it? In whose hands it will be.
Yeah, that's
and
why
I
you
think
need
Yuval's vision of, you know, most of the world playing computer games in the future, because that's how we sort of keep them quiet or whatever. Mm. I mean, who is going to be writing the stories on those computer games that somehow give the mass of humanity a sense that their lives have some kind of meaning? Otherwise, they'll end up just being in perpetual revolution.
That's right, yeah. No, but I think this is exactly why we need to create the right kind of education system, right kind of media, right kind of political rules.
Do you see anywhere in the world the right kind of education system emerging, either of you?
No, unfortunately, I don't know enough about the education systems around the world to say anything meaningful about that. But, I mean, let me just give you one quick example. I mean, the American politics, I mean, you know, I think that things will become quite different there if you abolish this campaign financing and political advertising on TV, you know. I mean,
you mean if you wouldn't allow wealthy people to just
exactly,
spend
yeah.
their money
well,
on their
you
own
could
campaign.
You could also say that we might improve the statistics of obesity around the world if we abolished advertising for sugary drinks.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
yeah.
there are a lot, but yes. actually no one can get a handle on it at all at the moment.
Yeah, in Sweden they cannot advertise for toys. No,
have you thought of standing for office, Arjun?
No. Okay. It's a very bad idea.
We'll
I mean, academics that are running countries, no.
So I think we should open it up. I mean, it's very interesting that Yuval lives in Israel. If you go to Tel Aviv, there's an incredibly intelligent, also technologically savvy, liberal sensibility. And yet, somehow, you know, peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis is elusive. And yet there are all these clever people there. I mean, what's going on in the world? You know, it's just the idea that this should have gone on for as long as it's gone on for is shocking. Anyway, let's now, we've opened up a can of worms here because this is so, lots of hands, I'm sure. We need to make sure, have we got a microphone? And you need to stand up and speak out if you can.
Speak into the mics, where are they?
You need to take one of these mics. You've got one. So if we can start.
But if someone asks a question in Spanish, I mean, do we have the...
We have no headphones in case anyone asks in Spanish. I'm sorry. So
if we've got a translator in the house...
Well, someone will... Okay, we do have. All right.
These guys have got to answer the question.
Yes. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. Shouldn't we, humanity, be seeking to achieve better goals than economic growth, economic value? In other words, what would be the ideal measure of success for a society?
What would be an ideal measure of success if it's not economic growth? What
yes,
would it be?
Well, I mean, very roughly speaking, I think up to a certain level of income, there is a very positive correlation between economic growth and people's living standard and happiness. Now, there's a debate as to where that level is. I mean, that anywhere between $10,000 and $20,000 per capita income. But it's very clear that below $10,000, there's a very strong correlation. So those countries that could derive a lot of positive things about that from having better economic growth. But beyond that, it's more a matter of sharing more fairly and taking care of the weaker people and giving the meaning to the people's lives. I mean, beyond that level, having more money doesn't really make you happier, and it will probably destroy the planet.
Let me ask a quick follow-up, especially for because you've looked back in time. Was there a period, because what you've just described is the way many people in this room would think that's about fairness and allowing people to rise to a certain point and grow and be out of poverty, and that is not happening today. Was there an era, when you go back into your 70,000 year history as you have, and we know that 100 years ago there was still slavery, so we haven't, you know, it's not long ago, no. It's yesterday, you know. So where is there an example of a society which did operate in ways where the attitude and the approach might help us today?
All societies that we know about were dissatisfied with their conditions. Humans seem incapable of being satisfied with what they have. The basic human reaction to achievement, any kind of achievement, is usually not satisfaction, but craving for more. And we now sit and we say, $10,000 per person, that should be enough to make people satisfied. I'm convinced that in 50 years, yeah, when we have Cartagena 2076 or something, somebody will be sitting here and said, $1 million per person, this is the absolute minimum, below that.
Yeah, but we have definitions like relative poverty, yeah, has entered the economic jargon, and that's a very specific thing.
Yeah, I think that the main thing we need to realize is that deep in the human mind, there is this bottomless hole that can never be filled. And no matter how much we throw inside, there is always a demand for more. We don't know of a society. I mean, the societies that came closest to being satisfied with their lot are the earlier societies of hunter-gatherers, who the main thing about being a hunter-gatherer is to adapt yourself to the environment and not change the world so that it will adapt to your dreams and your cravings. But it's completely impossible to go back to that world. As hunter-gatherers, there are about 7 million people in the whole planet. Yeah. Today, we have like 7 or 8 billion people.
Yeah, it's worth saying that, of course, if what we want from the world is to do is more, that's one thing, but more of what? More insight, more knowledge, more pleasure, more love, not necessarily more money. Enough money, but other things. Do we have to change people's priorities in terms of what they want? Just because you have a lot of money and other people don't have a lot of money, it's back to this idea of fairness. Anyway, another question, sorry.
Jabal, I think your diagnosis of leaders without vision is extremely critical. Do you have any ideas how communities or societies could address the issue of nurturing leaders with vision to face the challenges of our century?
I said earlier that one of the keys is to break the barrier between science and politics, because you can't have a meaningful political vision in the 21st century which is not informed and based on a good scientific understanding. This is new. Previously in history, politics and science really could be divorced from one another, but it is no longer the case. So my impression is that if I had to bet where the new ideologies, where the new religions of the 21st century will come from, I would bet on Silicon Valley, not on the Middle East and not on Washington.
Yeah. Okay, another question.
Hi, this is a question for both, and it's going back to vision. as you mentioned, Stalin, Mao, and Hitler had visions. However, it was only their vision. And the result of that was totalitarianism, human misery, genocides, and thwarting also human development. What the liberal promise at least says is that I have my vision, he has his vision, you have your vision, and I'm allowed to pursue my vision without you interfering with mine. Now the problem with that is that it leads to inequality, and it also leads to another kind of subtle slavery, because very few people are able to determine how most people work and how most people live their life. My question to you is there a middle ground? Can we create biologically a superhuman being that not only has super brains but also super heart?
First of all, about the liberal vision, it's true that the liberal vision is that everybody will have his or her own vision, but the liberal vision itself is a single vision, which was an extreme vision. If you talk to people in previous eras, then we don't usually think about it, but we tend to associate extreme visions with Hitler and Mao and say, luckily, it didn't succeed, but we are living an a very extreme vision which succeeded, and therefore we take it for granted. But the liberal vision itself is no less extreme than the Nazi or the communist vision. It's simply more successful and, I would say, more benign, more good. But it's not that you had these extreme visions and we avoided them and we went with something quite natural. I mean, no, eventually humankind opted for a very extreme vision. For millions of years, humans did not live as individuals. Yeah. They lived as groups. They lived as collective. The liberal vision is an extreme vision because it is based on breaking the basic biological bonds and even nature of humankind, breaking the atoms of human society, the family, the community, and saying, no, we will have a world which is not based on families, which is not based on communities, it's based on individuals. It doesn't sound very extreme because it's all around us. But looking from 70,000 years of history, this is as extreme as anything that Mao and Hitler wanted to do.
So you are saying that liberalism is about the individual having more being more empowered, really, in the end, more vested in than actually the community or society or the family or anyone else.
Yes, and
you have the right to be who you want to be.
Exactly, and the link with capitalism and neoliberalism is that people say, wait, but if everybody's an individual and everybody does his own thing, so what will take care of the great visions of the economy, of politics? And then you have the neoliberals coming and say, oh, don't worry. Each individual should just pursue his or her own dream, and market forces will take care of all the rest.
But don't
so the two things actually are, we want to have to eat the cake and still have it. Mm-hmm. We want to have a world of individuals doing their own thing, and still we don't like market forces taking care of all the big decisions, but it goes together.
We're coming away from capitalism, from market forces, talking about other ideologies. What about religion? The point about Islam and Muslims is that they absolutely share of Islam. Individualism is not permitted, really, essentially. Is that the antidote to this world which has not provided for many, many people who are, you know, living terrible lives? And, you know, a liberal economic sort of so-called democracy, which is making decisions, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Libya or here or there, about their own needs and their own wants, to feed their own interests. Is that anger means that they are collectively incredibly powerful because they are doing what they are told to do and they don't care if they live or die.
I think in one way, then yes, the rise of things like Muslim fundamentalism is a reaction to the failure of the globalized liberal vision. when the Cold War ended in the 1990s were an extremely optimistic decade. And the story, the myth, that neoliberalism sold all over the world in the 1990s is, look, we now know what works. All you need to do in Egypt, in Nigeria, wherever, all you need to do is just adopt the neoliberal package of individualism, democracy, free market, etc. And within 20 years, you will all live like Americans. And 20 years later, somebody wakes up in Cairo and looks around and says, it doesn't look like Springfield, it still looks like Cairo. And then I've been cheated. Like, globalization didn't work. I mean, it worked for some people, but not for everybody.
Okay, next question.
Yeah. Thank you. One question for Hayun and one for Yuval. Hayun, on Kicking Away the Ladder, you show how protectionism made developed countries what they're right now. But there is also a history of colonialism. Without slavery, the Industrial Revolution would have never happened. We've got Manchester, Liverpool, and then what it seems is that we, the third world, we exist to be plundered, and we help the others to achieve those revolutions. So what will be our place in the future, in the forthcoming industrial revolutions or technological revolutions? And Yuval, it seems we've got this Manichaean division from savage to civilized, backwards, advanced, developed, and developing. And now you're talking about superhumans and others which will not be superhumans in the future, as far as I understood. So what I'm thinking is whether these new technological evolutions or advances will continue that colonialist discourse of dividing the world in the winners and losers.
So that's about colonialism and about that relationship now with now. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I think, first of all, the Uruguayan writer, Eduardo Galeano, in his book, The Open Veins of Latin America, I don't know what the title is in Spanish, said that some countries are specialized in being poor, and others are specialized in being rich. You know? And this is, unfortunately, the dark side of the capitalist history. People talk about 19th century liberalism, but yes, I mean, there was slavery, imperialism, colonialism. Yeah. When the Latin American countries became independent in the 1810s and 20s, they were bullied into signing the so-called unequal treaties where they gave up the right to try foreign citizens committing crime in their land and giving concessions on gold mines and giving up the right to set their own tariffs. So, yes, it's a very, very ugly history, and unfortunately, you know, the only way that developing countries can be taken seriously is to basically stop being one. Yeah? And then this requires economic development, which requires basically raising productivity, and, you know, the countries that have succeeded all knew this, and when the British told the Americans, adopt free trade. You know, Adam Smith told the Americans to adopt free trade, not to engage in protectionism. Americans said, well, up yours, yeah? We are going to protect our industry. You know, throughout the 19th century, the USA was the most protected country in the world. Yeah? When the Japanese were told by the Americans in the 50s, open your markets, the Japanese said, I'm sorry, that we cannot do that. We have to develop our economy. So, yes, I mean, this game has
and
one major
today,
problem, which is that we might, in the process, destroy the planet. Yeah? But, you know, at least in the short to medium term, unless you get out of this specialization of being poor, no one's going to take you seriously. And it's not a very nice conclusion, but that's the only conclusion I can draw.
Yuval, have you got a last word? Because this is...
I think that it's now very urgent for these underdeveloped countries or developing countries, because it's basically the last train to leave the station. In the 19th century, you had these gaps opening between countries, but if you missed the train, you could still catch the next train with the help of things like cheap labor. You don't have know-how, you don't have industry, don't have any, you have cheap labor, and if you manage relatively okay with cheap labor, you can catch the train eventually. This is what China has done. This is what many other countries have done. But in the 21st century, there is a very big danger that if you miss the train this time, the train of biotechnology and computer science and artificial intelligence, you will never be given a second chance because cheap labor won't count for anything. When AI and robots can do everything, who needs cheap labor?
Yeah, yeah.
So if you don't catch this train now, you won't get a second chance. And history in this sense is merciless. You can't come to history and say, oh, look, we have all these internal problems, we have corruption. Give us some 50 more years, we'll solve all this problem. And then, no, it's like in the 19th century. If you missed the train, you had 100 years of British imperialism. Nobody gave you any discounts because you had internal problems. So it's the same thing now, just much worse. Mm.
So you've been warned. Don't miss the train, okay? All of you. Thank you. So thank you to Ha-Joon Chang, to Yuval, and to Rosie, and a lot there to think about. Thank you.